Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation episode number 334, Ramesh Srinivasan. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Looking for your next great hire? ZipRecruiter offers simple tools and powerful matching technology to find you qualified candidates efficiently and effectively. It's the smartest way to hire. Try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/triangulation. And by FreshBooks, the easy-to-use cloud accounting software for small business owners. Make this year your most productive year yet. Try it for free for 30 days at FreshBooks.com/triangulation. Welcome to Triangulation. I am Megan Maroney, and this is a show where we talk to some of the most interesting people thinking, writing about technology and its effects on our culture and our world. My guest today is Ramesh Srinivasan, who is at UCLA. He's the director of the UC Digital Cultures Lab, author of Whose Global Village, and his newest book, After the Internet, with Adam Fish. Thank you so much for joining me.
Nice to meet you, Megan. Thank you all for having me.
So,
appreciate it.
Before we get to the book, I want to start with talking about you, and your work is so interesting. So I want to find out how you got here. I know that your family was from India. You were born in Silicon Valley. Tell us a little bit about what that was like growing up, parents of immigrants in the Valley.
Well, I'm first generation Indian American. My family is from South India, and I was born in Silicon Valley. But I spent a lot of time as a young kid in India and traveling to different parts of the world. My parents are educators, so it was a pretty natural thing to think of myself as someone who wanted to go into education and teaching and maybe even research. My dad taught at Stanford in the business school, and my mother is a kindergarten teacher. So it was just something that was really ingrained in me. But I think what was also ingrained in me is just the love of travel, the love of diversity, the love of our world. One of the coolest things about being a professor is you have freedom to pursue what you care about and what you love. And one of the aspects of my father's lifestyle that was exciting for me was the opportunity to live and be in different parts of the world. So Silicon Valley at that time had like orange tree orchards. And it wasn't quite the valley that we know of today. You know, as we all know, it's gone through different waves of peaks and valleys. And you know, I actually went to the high school, and it wasn't a very good high school in my experience. But the same high school as Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak. So it had this kind of mystique about it. I think increasingly, like when I went to college and after college, I started to realize, and this is what a lot of my work is about, is that technology is not simply defined by how we create it. It's also defined by the places and peoples that it migrates to. So.
I know that technology is just part of our world right now. You know, it's everyone's world. You know, you don't ask someone like, how did you get interested in technology, who's growing up today? But, you know, for those of us who grew up in the late 70s, 80s, you know, everyone wasn't using computers. So how did you get interested in technology?
Yeah, I think it was, you know, when I was in college, I was one of those like split brain kids. I write with my left hand. I do a lot of other things with my right hand. And I think I always had a great amount of love for both like mathematical and scientific thinking. But I think I also realized, which not all engineers kind of recognize, that that's not the only way of seeing the world. In fact, that's only a very limited part of the way to see the world. So while I saw computers as really central and revolutionary in terms of what they could achieve for people on an intimate level and on a social level, I think what really happened for me was I started to realize that computing, again, was cultural, right? Like computing could be global. computing was going to shape our lives in all sorts of interesting manners. So for me, my love of people and diversity and equity and these kinds of values was actually inspired through thinking about technology rather than seeing technology in a vacuum or as somehow like separated from those things. So I saw technology also, and as we've seen this over the last like 20 years, as you alluded to, Megan, I was seeing technology as what we create, right? Like technologies are not fixed. Writing is a technology. The wheel is a technology. People and cultures and human beings and societies create technology. So I saw myself as having the possibility of being part of a world where we can define what kinds of technologies first and foremost serve human beings and serve the values that we hold as humans.
So one of the big arguments is in your book is about the digital divide. And, you know, Facebook and Google, they talk about, you know, like, we have to get the internet to everyone. Everyone needs the internet. But that assumes that everyone wants the internet, which is essentially in many, many ways the American internet. Talk a little bit about that fallacy of the digital divide.
Yeah, I mean, the digital divide is fortunately one of those principles that which has had its enough holes poked into it where no longer is it like a widely accepted way of thinking about technology. But basically, the digital divide was super sexy like 15, 20 years ago. And it's funny to think of the digital divide as sexy. Anyway, for me, it was really sexy and interesting. But I think about 5 years ago or so, I think people started to drop the idea a little bit. And so what does the digital divide mean? It means essentially that the divides in our world can be somehow resolved or ameliorated by the mere spread of technology and access to technology. But what that whole premise doesn't even begin to consider is whose technology, right? How are those technologies being built? Who's behind the agendas that distribute technology? Who profits from those technologies? Again, what are the values that drive the distribution and dissemination of technology? And for me, it blocked, I think, a much more interesting question, which is, can we think about technology in ways that support diverse and marginalized people rather than thinking like our Western tools will save other people? That is a deeply flawed logic. Not only will it not work, it's also on some level unethical.
It's interesting that you say the digital divide was sexy. Like, it was a sexy thing to talk about and be interested in. And when you think about, like, Facebook Free Basics, which I guess is internet.org now, that was the big thing that Mark Zuckerberg was pushing. Like, we're going to get the internet to everyone. And you don't hear him say anything about it at all anymore. And, like, it just seems like it's a completely different company what they're dealing with now. So why do you why did it fall out of favor, and is it a good thing, or is there just another problem now with the way we think about the internet from a global perspective?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, the Facebook Free Basics program, just so I can explain that, was Facebook's attempt to expand access to the internet to what are sometimes described as the next billion. Some say the term last billion, which is a term I find problematic, and some even say use the term bottom billion. Mm-hmm. But actually, realistically, we're talking about 3 or so of the 7 billion in the people in the world that don't have really robust access to the internet. So Facebook and Google, in different ways, are trying to expand access to the internet. Now, the Free Basics program was problematic from the start. And the reason why it was problematic was because it wasn't a net neutral internet. It wasn't an internet that respected the openness that has always been part of the internet in its best moments. It was an internet that was skewed toward those who advertised with Facebook. So what you're actually getting is something like a mail order catalog or like some kind of like advertised set of advertisements, right? And that is not the internet, and that's not the internet that is desirable. So, you know, that project got some scrutiny, and it got booted out of India, which was a pretty notable moment. And, you know, now Facebook is, of course, really, you know, dealing with quite a bit of other forms of criticism. So I think as a result of it, I think it's not trying to deal with the Free Basics program. But I have no doubt in my mind that it's in Facebook's best interest to try to spread access to the internet, even if that internet is open. The reason why is because more people connected to the internet generally means more people connected to Facebook or Facebook-owned products. So remember, Facebook shouldn't be just defined by that social media website we go to. Facebook is a corporation, and as a corporation, it has strategically acquired a set of other companies that suit its interests. Instagram is the most notable. WhatsApp is another. These are companies that have billions of users, over a billion users in the case of WhatsApp, and the data goes to one place. It goes to Facebook. So it's in Facebook's interest to expand access to the internet. I thought it was particularly ridiculous that they were trying to push forward an advertiser-only internet or an advertiser-sponsored internet. But fortunately, it seems like they've backed up on that a little bit, at least at this point.
So when I look at technology, I'm often just shocked by the fact that so much technology is organized around what people in Silicon Valley want. And oftentimes I'm saying, you know, they're looking at, you know, it's created by white men often. And so like they're not looking at the woman's perspective, or they're not looking at, you know, people who live not on the coast's perspective. But reading your book made me realize like that I am missing the rest of the world's perspective because, I mean, it is there's no thought to the experiences that other people are having. So talk a little bit about your field work and what you learned through that.
Yeah, no, thank you for asking that question. Remember, the internet and access, especially like Google, Facebook, Amazon, Apple, like these biggest technologies have massively penetrated the Western world, right? So like the places where these technologies and therefore these corporations can expand to tend to be parts of the world in the global south, as we describe it. These are parts of the world like South Asia, Indonesia, Pakistan, some parts of sub-Saharan Africa. So the goal is to get these products into the hands, data grabbing, data collecting, attention monetizing products into the hands of people in these parts of the world. So because there's so many of those people, you can capture so much more data, and therefore you can be valued that much more, and you can get that much more in terms of advertising revenue. So what that, much like the digital divide, but I think even more problematically, what that assumes is, you know, we can build the internet in our image that all these, you know, generally speaking, black and brown people and women, your good point on that, are going to use. It's our internet that will solve their problems. I mean, sometimes the discourse is as ridiculous as that. And that is incredibly myopic and problematic. And the reason why is because it basically assumes, you know, whether they would say it or not, that the vast majority of people in the world from such diverse cultures, such diverse histories, traditions, way deeper in many ways than, you know, us who are 240 years old in this country, you know, that their voices shouldn't be part of the global internet, or that their voices and values should not determine their engagements with technology or even how we design technology. And so this is not just a conversation, Megan, about technology. It's actually about diversity, and that's really important in the context of like climate change and our world witnessing a massive loss of language and plant and flora and fauna diversity. You know, like we are losing diversity as we speak. Climate change is contributing to that. And the internet is also potentially contributing to that, because if we build the internet in a Western corporate dominated way, we're going to flatten everybody else. And flattening is not good if the flattening is done by the West, right? So this is a huge issue. I mean, I think we can, instead of sort of thinking that we can just kind of collect and monetize billions of other people, we can actually learn from them and rethink technologies in those ways. Because like this is ultimately like the major point of both my books. You know, who builds technology? People build technology. People within cultures, within societies, often within businesses. So we don't have to have this kind of narrow black box, you know, opaque, secretive corporate way of dominating the platforms that now dominate the internet. That does not have to be the way we create and design technology. We can do way better. We can get back to the idea of listening to the world instead of making the world or dominating the world.
So your book, After the Internet, It opens with a quote from John Perry Barlow, who passed last week. He imagined the internet as a great many things. And one was, and this quote says, it was a place where no one would be coerced into silence or conformity, which we know not to be true. Talk a little bit about why you chose this quote to begin this book, this Barlow quote. I'll read it. We are creating a world where anyone, anywhere may express his or her beliefs, no matter how singular, without fear of being coerced into silence or conformity. That was John Perry Barlow in 1996. Why did you choose that quote?
Well, I think that that spoke to the what seemed really inspiring and promising about the internet at that time, right? And my goal, and I want to be really clear, even though I'm very critical about where we're at right now, I don't think that this is necessarily where we have to go. I don't think that this is where we were just a few years ago, and I don't think that this is necessarily where we have to be in terms of the internet and digital technology in 5 years or 10 years, right? I mean, the companies that are now dominating the internet in a secretive fashion are babies. They're younger than both of us. In fact, they're like less than half my age. John Perry Barlow is a really interesting figure. May he rest in peace. And the Electronic Frontier Foundation are friends of mine, the organization that he founded. I think there was a certain type of bold, freedom of speech kind of set of ideals that drove that declaration of cyberspace that Perry Barlow famously wrote. I think there are some very powerful aspects of that, of an internet where the decentralized access to create and share information could, in theory, empower us all to share our stories, share our voices. The problem is what happened is as the amount of information exploded, right? Trillions and trillions of web pages up on the internet. We needed to turn to platforms to reduce the noise and figure out how to deal with the noise and morass of information. So what happened is we turned to search engines, and we basically started to trust algorithms that didn't just pull information from us when we searched for information, but pushed information onto us, right? Like we just keep seeing things pop up on our phone, on our, whenever we log into various websites, even on like Apple TV, if you will, or what have you. So I think in many cases, what John Perry Barlow was rooting for is not the moment we inhabit, as you pointed out. But I do think it's a good guiding light to kind of get back to. I think what Perry Barlow missed to some extent, I don't think it was necessarily intentional, is that we shouldn't just define the best cases of the internet in terms of individual liberty, but we need to think about our communities as well and our cultures. Because we are not just a bunch of isolated, atomized, freedom-seeking individuals. I think that's a standard libertarian way of looking at the world. I think we are best understood not just as individual beings, but as social beings, right? So let me give you an example. If all I cared about was my own selfish, if you will, property value, and I don't mean that in a loaded way, just if all I cared about was how much my house was worth, my house property value has everything to do with the quality of the public school system in my neighborhood, or the quality of health and medical care and public health in my neighborhood. Those are social systems. Those are community systems. Those are systems about the communities we live in. So the strongest and healthiest communities are the strongest and healthiest ways of taking care of ourselves. So that's an analogy from like the non-digital world, but I think it applies really well to how we should be thinking about our communities in the digital world. And I think what's really problematic is we've let very secretive companies like Facebook define what community is for us, but we don't even know what the boundaries are by which they articulate community and how they expose or not expose us to community. And we know ultimately that what those companies are attempting to do is maintain our attention. And that's not necessarily something that is inherently aligned with the purposes of community.
So yeah, what you're talking about is that black box algorithm that Facebook has and Google has and so many of these companies, well, the big companies have, that we just don't know about, and it's controlling so many parts of our lives. Was that inherent to the internet in the beginning, or when did that become the norm, that there was this black box that these companies could keep these secrets in? Has that always been part of the internet?
No, it hasn't. I mean, remember, like early internet was about it was about creating you know, what we call decentralized networks, where like I could be here in Los Angeles, you could be at Stanford. I mean, that was literally the first point to point of the internet, a signal sent between UCLA and Stanford. So it was supposed to be decentralized, where anyone in theory anywhere, I mean, this was more of an ideal, but anyone in theory anywhere could access anyone else who is connected anywhere else. And the early kind of important spaces of the digital world were online communities that actually came out of, emerged out of people and people like John Perry Barlow, right? Kind of hippies and Whole Earth Catalog and you know, sort of countercultural figures who actually were environmentalists. So that's a whole different game. Now, the reason why we turn to algorithms, and algorithms are not unique to new technology. They've existed across cultures and societies for hundreds and hundreds of years. They come out of mathematics. But the reason why we turn to algorithms are basically patterns, rules that you can apply to bodies of information to extract some sort of, you know, insight in terms of what you might be looking for or what they want you to look at, right? So the reason why this kind of all went to algorithms is because the amount of information exploded. And so as a result, we started to trust those who could, quote unquote, order the information. I mean, what Sergey Brin from Google famously said would be like the mind of God, right? So, you know, not only is that problematic because it's universalist and it's assuming that they somehow could create that, but it also reflected this moment that occurred, I'd say about 15 years ago, where we said, hey, there's so much information out there. There's so much stuff that's out there on the web. We have no choice but to just kind of trust these search engines to kind of efficiently feed for us what we think we are looking for. The problem is we trusted these things blindly and we didn't understand that there was an underlying business model. And there's nothing wrong with building a business for an incredibly powerful technology. But the problem is what we end up seeing is based on what supports the benefit of the business, much more so than giving us any open-ended glimpse into why we see what we see. So, you know, as a result, we're at a moment right now, and the statistics are kind of approximate, but you know, 90%+ of people, when they log in to, when they do a Google search, for example, don't go to page 2 of the rankings, and about 70% don't click on anything after the first 3 search results. So imagine, you know, hundreds of thousands of potential results, most of them filtered out. You limit it to, you know, the 20, 30 or so results on the first page. And that defines your experience. And actually, what ultimately defines your experience are 3 search results. So I give multiple examples in my books of why that's problematic. It's problematic culturally. That's problematic economically. And really, as we've seen with our recent election, that's really problematic politically as well.
Yeah, the search engine piece is really interesting. When you wrote a piece in Quartz about a year ago about how these algorithms are reflecting our bias. And talk a little bit about that example you give, the Cameroon, searching for information about Cameroon.
Yeah, that's, thanks for bringing that up. And there's a couple other examples like that that I share in the book. So what I'm discussing there is, you know, just a really like kind of innocent, you know, you know, example where I was invited by UNESCO to visit the West African country of Cameroon. And one of the coolest things about the internet in theory is the ability to learn about other people and places in their own words, right? Not based on the CIA World Factbook, not based on, not even based on Wikipedia, which we've found to be asymmetrically dominated by English language content and editors from the Western world. And so that creates problems too. So I was talking about how Cameroon is not a country that is not online. In fact, it has a pretty robust amount of internet access. And it's actually a country where people speak both French and English, and of course, a range of other indigenous and local languages. So there are actually a significant number of web pages from Cameroon that are on the internet. But lo and behold, I was not to find any of those on my first page of search results when I searched for Cameroon, which means that not only is Google probably not understanding someone like me very well, and I've given them quite a bit of my data for many years, it's not giving me what I'm looking for. It's giving me the CIA World Factbook or the State Department website or at best Wikipedia. And that's a problem because what I'm interested in is the opportunity to at least have the option to learn about other parts of the world from the perspective of people who actually are living and being in those parts of the world who happen to be online, right? So that means we are learning about one another based on how we choose to talk about one another. So that is a huge problem, right? I mean, in the context of issues like climate change or issues like global diplomacy, that means the internet that is an internet dominated by proprietary black box algorithms is not actually opening us up to one another. It's actually further closing us down while presenting the mirage that we're actually learning from one another. And that's a huge problem. Huge problem.
Well, I want to keep talking about this problem. And I know that you have some solutions that have to do with digital literacy. And I want to talk about that and algorithms and political activism in the internet. First, we have to take a short break and thank one of our sponsors. Sure. This episode has been brought to you by ZipRecruiter. If you are hiring, you know what a pain that can be. It's exhausting. You'd rather just do the job yourself sometimes, but you can't do that. You have to find the right candidate. And one really good way to find a good candidate is by using ZipRecruiter. You've heard us talking about it for years, and we still love it. Every business needs great people and a better way to find them. Something better than posting your job online and just praying for the right people to see it. ZipRecruiter knew there was a smarter way, so they built a platform that finds the right job candidates designed for the job that you need to hire someone for. ZipRecruiter learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and then invites them to apply to your job. These invitations have revolutionized how you find your next hire. In fact, 80% of employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day, 24 hours, just one day. And ZipRecruiter doesn't stop there. They even spotlight the strongest applications you receive so that you never miss a great match. It's heartbreaking. You think, oh, there's got to be someone out there. If I just keep looking for hours and hours and hours, you don't have to do that anymore. They find you the best candidates. And you'll never miss them. The right candidates are out there. I promise. ZipRecruiter is how you find them. Businesses of all sizes trust ZipRecruiter for their hiring needs. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/triangulation. That's ZipRecruiter.com/triangulation. Don't forget to add the triangulation so they know that we sent you to them. ZipRecruiter.com/triangulation. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And we thank ZipRecruiter for their support of Triangulation. I am talking to Ramesh Srinivasan. He is the author of many books, two books, Whose Global Village and After the Internet with Adam Fish. And we are talking about the way that politics and culture interacts with technology and what's happening now. And talk a little bit about what you mean by the title, After the Internet. Where's the internet going?
So that's a title that Adam Fish, my friend, and I were sort of trying to be a little playful with. I mean, obviously the internet is here to stay, and it's defining. It's very, very central in our lives in so many different ways. And I'm actually working on a new book that I'll tell you about in a little bit, which is really trying to address the big economic, political, cultural flashpoints around the internet moving forward. So what do we mean when we say after the internet? What we actually mean is the internet, kind of like I said earlier, the internet as it is right now is a very different internet than the internet of 10 years ago, 15 years ago, and actually even 5 years ago. And by the way, even in the late 1980s, I know that's a long time ago, you know, early days of the internet, there was no commercial activity at all permitted on the internet. So we've gone from an internet that was completely non-commercial to an internet that's dominated by commercial stock valuation interests. So that means that we can actually think about what is after this internet, right? And of course, that doesn't mean that these companies are going to go away. That doesn't mean that aspects of what we are experiencing right now will still not be there. I mean, of course, aspects will be there. But I think what we're trying to do is inspire others to realize, again, that we have power in theory over technology, though it doesn't seem like right now. And in the sense, when I say that, what I mean is that we, in turn, can actually reimagine technology in ways that might support human values of equity, of diversity, of, you know, as John Perry Barlow pointed out, liberty and freedom of speech. Those are not the values currently being, prioritized with the internet of present, but there is a new internet after this internet that could shape some of those values, that could be inspired by some of those values. And our goal is not to just be, to not simply be in hysteria or depressed about that, which is, we can change this situation and make it better. And I think that to some small extent, at least, we see some acknowledgement of these issues by even some of the folks in Silicon Valley.
Well, I know one big movement right now is the movement by the Center for Humane Technology. Talked to Max Stossel a few weeks ago on the show. He's one of those that was back in the olden days, a month ago, when they were called Time Well Spent before they changed their name. What are your thoughts about the Center for Humane Technology? Because I think that their focus is very different. I mean, it's different than yours. I mean, you have a more broad, global perspective, which I found very refreshing after reading and buying into a lot of what the Center for Humane Technology is doing, but at the same time thinking, well, it seems like a lot of people are running around saying, oh, you gotta save the children, and that's maybe distracting us from a lot of the stuff you're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, you just actually referred to what I think is sort of a little incomplete about that center. You know, I admire and appreciate their concerns to try to make the world of technology more humane. But to me, what they're attempting to do is they're dealing with some specific, and I use the word some and specific very intentionally, some specific problems or symptoms of the problem, rather than the underlying issue, which is one of asymmetric control. And asymmetric power. Youth addiction and depression through, you know, dopamine addiction is a huge issue, no question about it. And there was, for example, a study done by Duke that revealed how harmful it is to rely on social media as a form of socialization or as a form of validation. So that to me is just one small but important symptom of a much larger issue. So what I'm interested in is looking at examples that I believe are inspiring from different parts of the world where technologies are being not only imagined but implemented in people first manners, right? Culture first manners, value first manners. And this is not a zero-sum game with monetization and valuation, I think, of Silicon Valley. I just think that what the biggest companies have figured out is that they can create massive amounts of economic value for themselves and therefore their shareholders by optimizing their businesses and therefore their technologies in ways that are not socially beneficial, that are not socially healthy, that are not good for labor, that are not good for economic equality, that are not good for call center workers, that are not good for cultural diversity, that are not good for journalism and our ability in this country and the world to talk to and learn from one another. So I would really be a bit more excited about the Center for Humane Technology if they were focused on those issues.
And so I know you go into a lot of detail in your book about what's going on in some of these other cultures and yeah. Can you talk a little bit like just about yeah. some of that?
Yeah. So part of what I do in the book is I use my own training as former engineer and developer to write about projects where I work with various communities around the world to develop technology. So there's quite a bit in the book, between the books actually, about work I've done with indigenous communities, like Native American communities in the United States, where we're developing technologies that support their voices, their visions, the ways, their belief systems, their cosmologies, their political values. I mean, a lot of people don't even think about Native American communities and the history of this country in which we live. And my goal in being part of a process of collaboration with those communities is to serve and support their voices. And not because I think we need to be feeling negative or bad about ourselves, but because we can enrich the voices that inform how we understand one another. There are so many amazing initiatives all over the world where values are first when it comes to technology. We just don't think about those because we have such a dominant, overarching, overwhelming experience of information, and we have to turn to Google and Facebook products to deal with that. And I don't mean to conflate those two. They're kind of different companies, and they've both cornered the market in different ways, and I can talk about that with you. So I'll give you an example. Currently, I'm working with some incredibly inspiring figures that are responsible for the largest community-owned, that is, people-owned cell phone network in the world. And this is a project in the Oaxaca region in southern Mexico. These are communities of Zapotec, Mixtec, and Mije heritage that have not been provided with cell phone access by the big private corporations. So they are saying, hey, we can innovate. Innovation is not defined in Silicon Valley. It can be defined in our own lives, including technological innovation. So they're using open source technology and literally building their own cell phone networks that they own and are so much cheaper than if they were provided by a corporation, which the corporations have no interest in providing because they're not rich enough. They're not enough in number. So that's another example. In this country, in places like Detroit and Red Hook, and actually increasingly in other parts of the world, in Barcelona, we're seeing an expansion of what are called mesh networks, which is basically people and communities building their own intranet networks that are then connected to the larger internet through one point of connection. So we're seeing that in Detroit. So a place that has encountered so much loss, so much trauma, can actually be a place of reimagination and reinvention. We are also seeing really interesting examples in Uganda. I'm writing about an initiative of an AI laboratory, an artificial intelligence laboratory that is going to be developing automated systems, data mining systems, predictive algorithmic systems, but in ways that are first and foremost respectful of how Ugandans maybe see the world, Ugandan biodiversity, Ugandan linguistic diversity, Ugandan economic systems. There's really interesting examples of technologies that have been built and designed in various parts of East Africa as well. One is called Ushahidi, which made the rounds some years ago. It's human rights crisis mapping software, where basically people, independent of what kind of access they have, even if they have low-end, not data-equipped cell phones, can basically send information to the deployer of a system to visualize, what may happen, during an election. And this was software that was used in Haiti after the earthquake, so people could know where to deliver aid instead of trusting often pretty corrupt NGOs and institutions. So there's so much going on. In fact, there are more projects defined by values involving technology than not. And so that's why it's important for me in my writing not to simply be critical of the dominant forces, the the five companies, for example, that are worth over $3 trillion, which is incredible. But also to remember that even digital technology, even sophisticated, you know, networking technology can actually be created by people in diverse parts of the world. And there are examples of that all over the world. And so it's important for me to try to point those out so we can realize that we too can think about technology in such a manner.
So I want to talk about that differentiation between Google and Facebook and your concerns about each of them. I know earlier you said, you know, part of the problem was us just accepting them. You know, I can think back to my 25-year-old self in 1998, like discovering Google, and it was such a relief. I mean, you could, everyone right. is there. It's like instead of Yahoo or whatever else was just like, and it was, there was already commerce going on. What was beautiful about Google is like, there were no advertisements on the front page. You know, it was, this is wonderful. This is free. And it was free because then we began to give them, you know, our data and Facebook, there's a similar experience there. Like, look, I can so easily communicate with the people that I want to communicate with. They've created this for me and it's free. So talk a little bit about your different concerns about the two companies,
Sure. Well, you're definitely right. I mean, there are so first let me tell you what kind of ties them in common, and then I'll talk about what makes them different. So again, remember that we can't simply define Google or Facebook by, you know, Google search engine or Facebook's social media website, Facebook.com. We have to define them by other companies they acquire, and in Google's case, the many, many other technologies that they've built. And they both deserve credit for creating appealing places for us to go to, and in different ways, they have brought value to their users. So I don't want to, dismiss these things in some sort of armchair way. What makes them similar, unfortunately, sadly, is not only their use by billions of people, which in itself is not problematic, but the ways in which they drive our use, the ways in which they drive our usage, and specifically the ways in which they drive and control our attention, and in some cases, generate addiction. So let me give you an example. The Guardian has done really good reporting on YouTube's recommendation system, and there was one very good piece that came out just about 10 days ago by Paul Ellis that discussed him on YouTube's recommendation algorithm. So one would think that YouTube's recommendation algorithm would be personalized, meaning, okay, Paul has looked for these pieces before, then he'll be interested in this. Or Ramesh has done this, so he'll be interested in this. So what Paul looked at, what Paul Ellis looked like, is he uninstalled all profiling software on his machine and took out the cookies and so on. Didn't eat the cookies. Took out the cookies and then saw like what happened. And what happened was the recommendation algorithm, the AI systems, which we can talk about, that power the recommendation algorithm, took him from somewhat normal content to more and more extreme, violent, hateful, and dystopic, morbid content. Mm-hmm. So that is really interesting. Why does it do that? And the reason why it does that is because, you know, as human beings, we have both wonderful and problematic sides to ourselves. We are interested in the morbid. We are interested in violence. We are interested in dopamine hitting gratification. But we also feel the loss from those forms of engagement. We feel the effects it has that are unhealthy on us. And what YouTube's recommendation algorithm, much like what Facebook is doing right now with its recommendations, or in other words, what is filtered on your newsfeed, is skewed toward that which generates that which is attention grabbing in the worst possible manner for us. And that's why in the Facebook case, we see so much fake news, misinformation, alt-right content, etc., populating and proliferating on Facebook. And we also see the same thing happening on YouTube. So basically, well, why is that? Well, it's not because the algorithms or even the companies want to be unethical, they want us to be violent. It's nothing intentional like that. It's the learning systems they built are optimized for our attention, which means the more time we spend on the platforms, the more data we provide. The more data we provide, the more advertising revenue. The more advertising revenue, the greater the capital corporate stockholder valuation. So if you optimize platforms that are supposed to serve the public interest, at least you use branding language along those lines in public ways, you are actually being hypocritical in terms of what you're actually building out and how that's affecting our societies. And so now we're seeing extremely material, impactful effects of these dominant technologies on our lives. And so in Facebook's case, there are just numerous examples that are problematic, right? Like we see, for example, ProPublica doing some really good, interesting research where they could spend, I think, just like under $100 and access 3,000 people that the Facebook, you know, sponsored post algorithm identifies as Jew hater, right? This is basically what Russia did with the $100,000, accessed millions of people with misinformation. And this is not a story about Russia. This is a story about Facebook and Facebook's ability to use data to micro-target people in a divide-and-conquer manner. This is also partly what Cambridge Analytica was up to, which Steve Bannon is on the board of and was also a company involved in the Trump campaign and the Ted Cruz campaign before that, which is something I talked about live on Morning Joe some years, a little over a year ago. So, you know, it's kind of like, what do we want to optimize the digital world for? So Facebook and Google are similar in that way, but they're also very different. So the way in which Google has cornered the market is not just this YouTube recommendation algorithm. It's also by creating many, many, many interlocking products and services that, to be honest, are extremely well designed and I love and maybe you love that are all connected to one another, namely my accounts. So Google Maps, Google Drive, Gmail, YouTube, you know, et cetera, Google Hangouts. There's so many. They all are interlocking and connected. So they've essentially cornered the market where anything you may want to, obviously Google search, how could I forget about that? Anything that you may want to do on the internet more or less can be done through some Google platform, right? And Facebook has a little bit of a different strategy. It generates a sense of attention grabbing and addiction because it is optimized for you to kind of maintain this kind of gratification bias in the bubble that it provides for you.
Okay, I want to end on a happy note, so I'm going to take a minute to thank our sponsor, and then after that, I promise we're going to get to some of your points on how we don't have to continue like this. There are other things, as you've said, that we can do about this. But
definitely.
But first, I'm going to take a minute to thank one of our sponsors. Everybody's got a side hustle these days. You want to do what you love. It might not be your current major job, but you want to do it on the side. You want to have some freelance work, but then you don't want to have to do all the extra legwork, all the admin stuff. It's exhausting. It makes you want to just not do that project at all. But don't stop. Live your dream. Try FreshBooks. 44 million people have a second job. And if you're one of them, if you've got a side hustle, that passion project, a convenient source of extra income, you want to try out FreshBooks. Their intuitive dashboard will give you quick access to your spending, outstanding balances, total profit, and other accounting reports. You'll know how you're doing at any given moment, and you'll be ahead of the game during tax season. Anyone who's freelance knows you can just get overwhelmed if you don't look at this stuff until tax season. You think, what? Don't let that be you anymore. With FreshBooks, you can send professional-looking invoices in seconds, save time accepting credit cards online, and get paid an average of 2 times faster. No more chasing clients for payments. No more waiting in line at the bank. You can accept credit card payments directly just from your invoice. You can see what invoices have been sent, viewed, and paid, as well as overdue and outstanding invoice totals. You can create proposals with rich text content, add images, there's customizable sections, and more. This is a template that you can make your own. Know what you did and when you did it, so you'll never leave money on the table again. FreshBooks makes it easy to bill the time, buy client, and buy specific project. And with the FreshBooks app, you can stay connected to your clients and keep tabs on your business no matter where you are. FreshBooks automatically connects to your bank account and then updates expenses daily. You can just take a picture of the receipt. So easy. Just take a picture, upload it, and then FreshBooks does all the rest. From payment reminders to late fees, automate as much or as little as you'd like to so you can get back to doing what you love. Make this year your most productive year yet. With FreshBooks, you'll be ready when tax time comes and you'll be set up for success when you decide to turn your passion project into a full-time gig. Try FreshBooks free for 30 days at freshbooks.com/triangulation and enter triangulation in the how did you hear about us section. That's freshbooks.com/triangulation, and we thank FreshBooks for their support of this show. I am talking to Ramesh Srinivasan. He is the author of After the Internet and Whose Global Village, both books about the intersection of politics, technology, surveillance, algorithms. There's so much in your work. Let's spend a little bit more time talking about algorithms. I wonder your thoughts. I've been reading a lot about the Algorithmic Justice League, Joy Bwami, and just she does a lot of research on just all this technology and how really like just she, you know, she'll be in a room and the facial technology will work for facial recognition technology will work for everyone but her. Talk a little bit about that work.
Yeah, I mean, her work is fantastic. And I was just reading the article that was up on the New York Times just a few days ago. I'm sure you looked at it, Megan, where we were seeing how AI systems that were being built out by various companies are having significant bias between in terms of recognition of men versus women, as well as recognition of people of color versus Caucasian people. And so, of course, the biases are toward white males. And so why is that? Well, there are multiple explanations for this. One is because those that tend to run these big dominant companies, right, are white males, and therefore the higher up executives in many cases are also tend to be white males. Not always, but sometimes people like me, Asian males, right, are also part of the picture. And so as a result, they're creating systems kind of based on that way of looking at the world. But I think it's a far more interesting and problematic set of issues that inform AI, which is those systems are learning from the data that are out there in the world. And that's very similar to the example, the kind of hilarious and problematic example of Microsoft's bot, Tay Tweets, that within, I think, a couple days turned racist, homophobic, misogynist, and started hashtagging MAGA. So, you know, and there are numerous other examples. Another one that I like to talk about, it was an algorithm, an AI system called FaceApp that was St. Petersburg algorithm that was supposed to make people's faces look more beautiful. It turned our handsome ex-president Obama's face much more white. So these are worthwhile examples to look at. They're examples of spectacular failure. So why is that? It's because these AI systems are built upon a biased world, and because they're built in secretive ways by companies that tend to be governed certainly by men and often by white men. So we can do better. Our AI systems need to be more transparent, and we need to have more interaction with automated systems so we know that they are not just reinforcing the biases that already exist and the biases in these companies. And part of what we can do is think about AI systems not in this kind of way where we just simply trust them as neutral. And that's kind of what's happening with our search engine results, like I was saying earlier. We have to think about automation in ways where it's controlled and regulated and where it supports human activities and supports human values rather than the opposite. So, you know, I'm very appreciative of work that Joy and others are doing. I think that's the work we need to do. We need to expose these problems and not just simply give in to these issues.
Okay, so we know that the algorithms are biased. Big companies are collecting our data and they're using it to create profiles. So we need digital literacy. What does that look like?
Yeah, and let me just also mention one aspect to this. It's no longer as simple as saying that, hey, I want to fix this AI system in this way. It's not like I or you can just enter in a new line of code or change the code and somehow that will spit out more fair results. These systems are learning from themselves and they're learning from one another. And if you want to kind of look into that, or your viewers do, like, look at deep learning. And what do I mean by that? Well, what are they learning from are massive multidimensional matrices of data that we are leaking out because we have these phones, right? So these phones are leaking out so much data. So much data can be bought even in public ways or from data brokers. And we're giving up so much data to these companies. So what we're actually realizing, and this is a concern actually that I think is more prevalent in Silicon Valley, is that these systems are taking on their own forms of recursive intelligence. So of course this lends itself to this kind of, you know, it's a Terminator problem. So we get all the kind of folks like Elon Musk and even Sam Harris, you know, make these kind of comments like, oh, we're going to develop a new super powerful species. And I think the problem is much more basic and much more fundamental. We shouldn't go into the world of sci-fi if we realize in the world as is, we're developing so much bias. So to this point about literacy, it's one of many things that we need to do. But I think we have to figure out ways to demand alternatives involving technology where we can understand on some basic level why we're seeing what we're seeing, what data is being collected about us, give us the opportunity to see other possible results and other possible other possible pathways, potentially give us the opportunity to control what data is being used about us for what purposes, also control how data is being retained, right? So like data in theory that you and I put out when we were 18 might actually still be accessible at the age of 40, which is kind of incredible, right? What I did when I was 18, I would really not like to be part of my data profile 20 years later. So we need to develop literacy practices, but we also need to demand accountability and transparency. So if you're going to use kind of corporate civic language, Zuckerberg uses the term social infrastructure. Google uses quite a bit of public terms. Apple literally calls its Apple stores town halls, I believe, or like civic halls. So the brand is one of public. The brand is one of community. We need to demand actually the behavior that is community oriented.
Okay, so you mentioned that you're working on a new book. What can you tell us about that?
So this is really exciting. It's driving me a little bit insane because it's a book that is so much more adventurous and broad and expansive than anything I've ever done before. This is a trade press book with MIT Press, but they are going to put this book out in a much wider distribution than my first two. And what the book is looking at are different flashpoints of our digital future. So it's telling stories that are really clearly connecting technology projects to the values of their designers. And it may not be projects where the values are one that I personally am aligned with or that you may be aligned with, but it's far more explicit. So the point I'm trying to make here is that we tend to have this myth that, and human beings tend to treat technologies often as morally neutral. And so we use terms like disruptive, innovative, innovation, cloud. These are all terms that actually influence us to treat technology as morally neutral. And the other thing that's happened is, like Naomi Klein has pointed out, with the Trump administration and more, the brand has taken so much power. We buy into brands rather than the services they offer. So these are problematic issues. So instead of simply, I point out those issues, but instead of simply relying on those, I tell stories from different parts of the world of projects like what I mentioned earlier, where technologies are very, very explicitly connected to values. So I'm telling stories about the universal basic income, automation, and its connections to labor and labor movements all over the world, especially in the United States. I'm telling stories about mesh networks in different parts of the world. I'm telling stories about AI systems in Uganda. I'm telling stories about the project in Oaxaca, which is called Rizomatica. I'm telling stories about, I'm doing a chapter on Cambridge Analytica. This book also is going to feature interviews with pretty high profile figures. I'll be actually interviewing Noam Chomsky to talk to him. He rarely speaks about matters of new technology, but I'm actually going to be talking to him about these issues. So I'm going, he now lives in Tucson, so I'm going to go over there and meet him next month. I'm going to be interviewing Vicente Fox, who has now become popular because of his videos, his viral videos about Trump. But he's the former president of Mexico, and I'm going to be talking to him about his ideas around technology. And it's not because I personally am a devotee of these people. In fact, they're more different than similar. But I want to get their voices on the record, and I want to see what the world looks like when we bring those voices into conversation. I'm also talking to some folks in Silicon Valley. I have done an interview with Sam Altman, who is the co-founder with Elon Musk of the OpenAI movement, and is also the head of Y Combinator, and he's a billionaire looking and an investor and incubator in some of the big tech companies. So I'm trying to talk to a range of folks across the board. I'm trying desperately to reach out to folks at Facebook to see if they'll talk on the record with me. I managed to get a little bit of access to folks at Google, but it's been a little bit of a struggle. I'm trying my best to kind of have this kind of conversation about technology through the voices and examples I share in this book.
When can we expect the book?
Depends how quickly I can get it done and how organized I am. I am trying to get it written in the next year or so, but it's part of I forgot to mention I'm writing a whole chapter about blockchain as well, and I'm speaking to folks who are some of the earliest employees or earliest creators of Ethereum and some of the other blockchain currencies, and I'm trying to disentangle how blockchain technologies can actually serve people and communities for us rather than just be a new coin fetish. So I'm going to try to get it written by next summer. That might require me taking some time off and disappearing, but I don't think I will fully disappear because I'll be on the internet. And I certainly won't disappear likely in the eyes of Google or Facebook because I use WhatsApp all the time. But it's likely to come out, I think, in the fall of 2019 with MIT Press. And right now we're calling it We the Users. I'm not sure that's the title it's going to end up with, but you heard about it first.
That's really important work. I really look forward to that. The blockchain stuff is very interesting to me because it does in many ways feel like the beginning of the internet. Like it is similar to that, this idea.
Absolutely.
That, you know, that there can be a decentralized anything. Yeah. You know, that
exactly.
So,
exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. In fact, I'll just say one thing about it that's really interesting is you know, blockchain, you know, sort of developers and you know, apostles often point out how the problems with turning to what they call intermediaries, which are these platforms dominant by these companies. But blockchain should not just be this atomizing, you know, peer-to-peer kind of network. It has to also be understood in ways that support civic institutions, you know, our communities, our governments, our lives. So I'm trying to think about ways in which we can think about blockchain in, again, more public first, progressive first, people first manners.
Well, Ramesh, thank you so much for joining us. Ramesh Srinivasan is an associate professor at UCLA and the director of the UC Digital Cultures Lab, author of After the Internet, Whose Culture Is It? And
Whose Global Village?
Global Village? Author of Whose Global Village? Thank you. I knew I was getting it wrong.
Sure.
And a forthcoming book that we look forward to, possibly. What did you say the title was? We the Users?
Yeah, We the Users. I'm not sure what the ultimate title will be, but I would love to share the book with you. I really enjoyed speaking with you.
Oh, thank you so much. And you can follow Ramesh on Twitter. His work, he's at Ramesh Media.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. And thank you for spending your last hour with us on Triangulation. We really appreciate you watching. You can watch live. We record Triangulation every Friday at 3 p.m. Pacific. You can also download it whenever you please. You can watch it. You can listen to it. You can do both. You can find it at your favorite podcast catcher. Also, we'd love for you to fill out our survey. Go to twit.tv/survey. It just takes about 4 or 5 minutes. Not very long at all. We don't ask a lot our sponsors want to know a little bit more about you. Nothing really personal, just kind of what you would like to see on our network in terms of sponsorship. I am Megan Maroney. I can be found at Megan Maroney on Twitter and Instagram. And you can find more information about triangulation at twit.tv/try. We'll see you next week.